Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Mark Danner, who's the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib and the War on Terror. We'll be talking to Mark about the conviction of the Army Specialist who got 10 years in the Abu Ghraib as a result of the Abu Ghraib torture. But we'll look deeper into that subject. And Mark is leaving for Iraq on Tuesday to cover the elections. So beginning a sense of what he expects. We'll also speak with Stephen Roach, who's the chief economist at Morgan Stanley. Roach has written a piece in the forthcoming issue of Foreign Policy, which is highly critical of our nation's economic and monetary policy. In fact, he says that the Federal Reserve's Alan Greenspan is bringing the world to the brink of economic ruin. So I'll be looking into that notion that Greenspan is taking us down that path of ruin. We'll also speak with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, and we'll be talking to him about whether there's an alternative to the Bush foreign policy that seems to be unchallenged, and the likelihood that this after this election, President Bush and his team will declare victory and get out of Iraq, and that the press, who was so anxious and so much a part of the drumbeat to get into that war, will forget about it, and it'll become the nation will go through a collective amnesia, and that President Bush will escape responsibility for the deaths of at least 1,500 American soldiers and about 100,000 Iraqi civilians, leaving behind a disaster. So we'll be looking into that likely scenario. And I'm speaking now with Mark Danner, the author of Torture and Truth. Mark Danner, are you with us?
I am indeed, Ian.
It's good to talk to you. You're off to Iraq on Tuesday.
And Wednesday.
And I don't know, I was going to talk about it later in the program, but I just wanted to run this by you. My fear is that that this election will act as a fig leaf for a way out, and the administration is just desperate to get out of this mess that they've put this country in, and by extension themselves in, and that they will sort of declare victory and get out, and that the nation will move on to other things. The attention will move on, and there'll be just this gaping historical amnesia. Do you think it's possible that they could be that cynical, and that even if you leave behind a playground for Al Qaeda, will anybody notice?
Well, I think it's certainly possible. All indications are now, it seems to me, that there's a discussion within the administration about what to do. And I don't see any consensus yet having been formed about an instant or precipitous withdrawal. I think that many of the civilians in the Pentagon, in particular, Vice President Cheney, have been so committed to this war from the beginning. I think it would be hard to get out very quickly. I also think, just in practical terms, one can talk about getting out very quickly, but it's not so easy to do. There are 150,000 troops there, and to simply withdraw in a situation where you have the level of attacks, violence, insecurity, as it's called, that we've been seeing, I think would be politically rather difficult to do without some kind of rationale that was reflected in a change on the ground. So I tend to doubt it. I mean, it may well be that they are thinking, well, after the election, we're going to try to lay the groundwork eventually to draw down troops. But I can't see a precipitous withdrawal. I don't think they'd be able to do it.
But they must be aware that it's getting worse and gets worse by the day, and that there's essentially no way out of this morass that they put the nation into. And it would seem that one of the reasons that they want these elections so they're so anxious to have them go through, even though everybody says that it's unworkable. And even Brent Scowcroft said that, in fact, the elections may precipitate a civil war rather than bring a democracy. So isn't it true that it just gets worse every day?
Well, it does. I have no objection to that. I mean, I was in Iraq about a year ago, and when I arrived, there were 17 attacks a day, and there were something on the order of 150 now. And it's quite true that the war is going very badly, and that also, you know, when you're in a guerrilla war, essentially the old chestnut is the guerrillas win by not losing, the government loses by not winning. That is the time is on the side of the insurgents, and so I think the situation there is very bad. You and I have no quarrel about that. I'm just reluctant to say that, you know, you're going to have some kind of precipitous withdrawal after the election. I just think it's going to would be very difficult for the administration to do, given the commitments it's made, given the things it's said about Iraq and about its importance to the president's program of fighting terror. I think they'll have to show some kind of concrete improvement in the situation. That doesn't mean that they won't get out eventually. I just don't think that they can do it in the very near term.
Well, Seymour Hersh is reporting in the next issue of The New Yorker that, in fact, the opposite of what I'm suggesting, that the United States, particularly the Pentagon under Rumsfeld, is actively involved in inserting reconnaissance and sabotage teams into Iran as we speak, and that essentially the Pentagon has taken Iran away from the CIA, who are restrained by law, and that they're laying the groundwork for toppling the mullahs.
I haven't seen size piece, but from what I gather from interviews he's done, what he's talking about is planning going on and actual on the ground preparation going on for a set of attacks, perhaps to come as early as this summer, on plants and buildings in Iran that are connected to its program of nuclear weapons development. And this includes on-the-ground reconnaissance, the insertion of commando teams, and so on. I don't think it's, at least so far as I understand what Tsai is said to have written, I don't think it's an effort by itself to overthrow the government. I think it's actually the military option to respond to the Iranian nuclear capability. I think that's what he's saying.
But he is saying, though, that his sources, in particular in the Pentagon, believe that it will have the blowing up of their secret underground facilities will have the ripple effect of emboldening the Iranian opposition and making the mullahs seem less than invincible. And
yeah, well, that's, you know, this government has a long history of sort of telling
itself. Yeah, it's called faith-based foreign policy. Yeah,
yeah, it's very exactly. It's very similar to the notion of the you know, Iraqis coming out on the streets with sweets and flowers to welcome American troops.
Well, Mark, let's talk about your book, Torture and Truth: America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. Obviously, Army Specialist Charles Gray and was given 10 years. Many people think he's the fall guy. It's hard to believe. And in fact, I think it's pretty clear that this, from the torture memos, the so-called Bibi memo, and the recent confirmation of or hearings of Alberto Gonzalez, that these discussions took place at the highest level. It's hard to believe that both Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld weren't aware of what they were doing all along. And I guess my first question to you would be, how in God's name did these people think that you could break the Geneva Convention on torture and nobody would notice it, particularly in the age of digital cameras?
Well, I think that the age of digital cameras was probably not foremost in their mind when they decided to withhold Geneva Convention protection from prisoners and when they redefined what torture means. I think they were convinced that the only way to fight this war in this new paradigm, as Alberto Gonzalez, the White House counsel, called it, was to treat prisoners very harshly, torture them, in order to get information quickly. And I don't think that they had much interest in or ability to evaluate the political effects of the decisions that they were handing down, let alone the moral effects. So that I agree with you that, Private Grainer, as he now is, he's been demoted, is to some extent the fall guy. I don't think it's unjust that he's been convicted. He was clearly guilty of crimes and clearly is not a good guy, is a sadistic fellow. The fact is, though, that the trial has been used to essentially cover up wrongdoing by officials far up the chain of command. And during the trial, the judge, Army Colonel, was relentless in refusing to let the defense raise questions or call witnesses who would actually follow the chain of responsibility above Specialist Grainer up into the chain of command and talk about not only higher officers, some of whom have taken the Fifth, by the way, the equivalent of the Fifth Amendment, not only higher officers, but also higher government officials who were involved in making these decisions and changing these policies about what interrogators could and could not do to prisoners. So we've had, a trial that is supposed to, I think, give Americans the good feeling that this problem that they saw announced by the photographs that were broadcast last April and May by CBS and published by The New Yorker, that this problem has been settled. You know, you've punished the wrongdoer. But in fact, this way of convicting this guy and others of his very lower-ranking colleagues is essentially a way to stop the inquiry into those who were really responsible, those in positions of responsibility, all of whom essentially remain in office, some of whom, like Mr. Gonzalez, have been promoted or are about to be promoted from White House counsel to the highest law enforcement official in the United States, Attorney General.
And Mr. Gonzalez made it very clear in his confirmation hearings that he has no personal opinions about anything. He's just a team player. Senator Kennedy tried in vain to get him to express what he felt about torture, what he felt about what had happened.
Yes, well, he said that he had no. When pressed by Senator Leahy, Mr. Gonzalez said he had no real objections to the Bybee Memorandum, which you referred to earlier, which is the document from the Justice Department in August 2002.
By the way, Bybee was promoted to a judgeship for life.
Yes, he's out there in California, if I'm not mistaken, as a federal judge. And his memo, of course, redefined torture as an activity that had to cause pain so severe as to be equivalent to major organ failure or death, which puts many activities like waterboarding or feigned drowning, as the Times called it the other day, out of the category of torture, even though it's been a key tool in the arsenal of torturers in Argentina, Uruguay, the French, and Algeria, and elsewhere for years and years. You know, this is a very well-known torture technique. Suddenly it's not, and the Justice Department, in a memorandum that same month, August 2002, explicitly approved waterboarding for use by American intelligence agents on Al-Qaeda.
So it was terribly embarrassing to see that this is the our number one law enforcement officer is a man who is so shallow and so void of any real ideas, opinions. Just his main qualification apparently is loyalty. But the idea that he had to think twice about whether cutting somebody's fingers off was torture. I mean, it seems to me that the whole nation has sunk into this into this collective disrepute. And I've spoken recently to some people who were involved in a government that we've been at war with, and they were saying that you cannot underestimate the tremendous effect that this revelation that the United States was torturing had on so many people in the Middle East who really held the United States to a higher standard. They simply couldn't believe. They think this it's one of the most damaging things that ever happened. Not, regardless of the military defeat that the nation is suffering in Iraq, they seem to think this was a greater defeat. So has anybody done any accounting on that? In terms of reporting, I mean, around the world?
I think it's become very clear since certainly the beginning of the Iraq War that the opinion of the United States, not only in the broader world, but especially in the Middle East, has sunk to levels that are unprecedented. You know, before the Iraq War, according to the Pew survey, one in five Jordanians, and this is an ally of the U.S., strongly approved of the United States. The most recent figures were 1 in 20, which is a very small number, needless to say. And you have even worse numbers throughout the Middle East and throughout the Arab world. You know, it's interesting, this, because it has been a key argument of the Bush administration that the war on terror, the global war on terror, can only be won through a political shift in the Middle East. That is that, as Condoleezza Rice put it at one point, we have to change the thinking of young Muslims so they are no longer tempted to fly airplanes into buildings in New York and Washington. The thought was that, you know, they have to be, young Muslims must be given hope, they must be given a vision of democracy, a vision of freedom, and indeed this is the ideological trappings of the Iraq War itself, that this is a way to reorder the Middle East, to bring a vision of democracy there, and to thus, in a way, drain the swamp out of which terrorism wriggles. And, you know, insofar as we can measure the effects of such a rather vague argument, the attitudes about the United States have gone in the other direction. They've gotten much, much worse, much, much more disapproving. And, of course, the torture and the images that came from Abu Ghraib, in particular the image of the hooded man with the wires attached to him from Abu Ghraib, the image of Lindy England holding the leash attached to the neck of the naked Muslim lying on the floor in Abu Ghraib prison, these have all had enormous potency politically around the Middle East. They've become symbols of what the U.S. does to Muslims, which is, of course, the very message of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. So it's very hard to think. I mean, we don't know what, if any, information, actionable intelligence, as the phrase is, was drawn from any of these prisoners. We do know that, according to the Red Cross and according to American military officers quoted in the Fay report, an Army general, General Fay, that somewhere between 70 and 90% of the prisoners in Abu Ghraib had nothing to do with the insurgency, had no actionable intelligence. We do know, I mean, I think you can say pretty clearly that it's hard to think what intelligence could have been drawn from the remainder 30 to 10% of prisoners that would outweigh the political damage that's been done to the United States, its reputation, and its political currency among Arabs and among Muslims as a result of these images and what they convey.
So we understand, Mark Danner, that the impulse comes from a frustration that not only were we strategically dumb and blind to getting in there in the first place, we've been tactically blind since about a couple of days after the April 10th victory, in quotes. So you understand that the frustration, and obviously the enemy that the insurgents, they seem to be more and more clear that the Baathists are running, and that they actually laid these plans well before the American invasion, in many ways, I thought that a lot of the suicide tactic, which is quite common, had to be, that was more in line with the Wahhabis, the Al-Qaeda types, and didn't seem to be a part of the playbook of the Baathists, even though the Baathists are incredibly ruthless, and they make Stalin and his terror machine look tame. It turns out that they're actually coercing Iraqis to become suicide by doing the old trick that Saddam used to do, which is to hold your wife and children and rape the kids in front of the person and break them down and make them do something, either confess, in this case, become a suicide bomber. So up against this kind of ruthlessness, what does the United States do?
Well, I think it's very difficult. I mean, it's history shows that it's very difficult to defeat an insurgency once it has become widespread and has the sympathy of at least a significant part of the population. And
it may not be so much sympathy as just, you know, that this is a country that's been lobotomized by fear. The Mujahideen ran it for 35 years, and they haven't gone away. That seems to be the fundamental failure of this President Bush's misadventure, that the Americans never gave the Iraqi people the assurance that the bad guys are going to go away. And now it would seem the Iraqi people think, well, the bad guys are inevitably going to take over. We might as well side with them.
Well, your characterization of the collective psyche of the Iraqi people may well be correct. My impression is that there are significant numbers of people in Iraq who resent the American presence and who believe that when a country is occupied, it's legitimate to fight against the occupiers. It's obviously complicated. The insurgency is very ruthless. It's clearly rooted in the Ba'ath Party organization that ran the country for 30 years and that was based on a cellular structure down to the neighborhoods, which makes it uniquely adapted to become a conspiratorial insurgency, as it indeed was before it took power in Iraq. I'm sure you're quite right that a lot of people are very fearful of these people. There's no question about that. They're using terror as a technique. They're doing it very efficiently. There's evidence, various discoveries were made in last April and May, a year ago, April and May, after the Americans came into Baghdad, of preformed suicide vests and, were discovered, a great number of them. It's clear that there were preparations made for this insurgency that went back long before the invasion in March 2003, that it was set up ahead of time. There's no question about that. I mean, your question to me was, what does the U.S. do? And I think that, there have been a lot of insurgencies in history, and some of them have been defeated. The examples always given are, Malaysia just after the Second World War and the Philippines in the early 60s. It is true, though, that it's extremely difficult once you have a degree of support that's relatively widespread, and that includes simply tacit support. That is, people who, out of fear or out of political agreement, whatever, will not tell the occupiers where safe houses are, where insurgents are. They simply will not cooperate in any way, which is the key to fighting an insurgency. You need intelligence cooperation. And we seem to long since have reached that point in Iraq. And the latest estimates from the off-the-record estimates from the military suggest there are about 20,000 active insurgents and perhaps 10 times that number of what the military calls active sympathizers. That's a lot of people. That's an awful lot of people. And if those numbers are accurate, it's going to be very hard for what is in effect about 60 or 70,000 American combat soldiers to have any effect on them. I mean, the U.S. has very few troops there. About half the total number of 150,000 are actually combat troops. And it's just not going to be feasible to defeat this insurgency with that number of troops. The only way to do it is to train enough Iraqis who actually can fight effectively to defeat them. And, that training process has not been going well at all, so far as we know. So I think, as far as the vision of defeating the insurgency, I think, at least as an American task, the prospects for that are very bleak. I think the only positive vision might be, you have this election, you get some people who have at least some political legitimacy at the top of an Iraqi government. They are able to make some political process. They are able actually to train a force effective, and perhaps you can make progress. But I think the prospects are very bleak.
Well, it would seem that if the Lancet, the English medical magazine, recently published an article suggesting that they did a survey and that about 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died from the beginning of this war to the present, and if you're killing people. That's 100,000 people who have died in the name of democracy. And given extrapolating out with their relatives, the fact that the U.S. has not brought security, it's actually more miserable. Its conditions are far worse. Many think that Saddam is starting to look good. I mean, no matter what you're saying in terms of what they can do military, militarily, it seems that they've already lost in terms of the average Iraqi. I mean, if I were an Iraqi, I would certainly not consider that the Americans are my savior.
Well, I think all of that is true. There's been a great deal of death and destruction, and you know that 100,000 figure is a very high figure, but it certainly, and it's quite arguable, but certainly there are tens of thousands of Iraqis have died since the Americans invaded the country. There's no question about that. And I think when you're talking about the political effect of the invasion, I think one thing you have to mention is the 6 weeks or so of utter law and order, lawlessness and disorder that followed the invasion, while American troops stood by and watched Baghdad given over to wholesale looting. The university, the museums, all of the government buildings, a lot of private homes. Essentially, the Americans stood by while the city was given over to utter chaos, and it damaged American credibility so severely it's never, ever recovered. And I think that was a critical point, and I think you can lay it, completely at the feet of Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush.
I thank you very much for joining us, Mark Danner, in Los Angeles. And let me try and touch base with you when you get back from Iraq, since you're leaving on Wednesday. Thanks a lot, Mark.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Mark Danner, the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. He's a staff writer with The New Yorker. And I'm now speaking with Stephen Roach, who's the chief economist at Morgan Stanley. Stephen Roach, you have an article in the forthcoming issue of Foreign Policy, which is highly critical of our nation's economic and monetary policy. In fact, you say that the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, is bringing the world to the brink of economic ruin. So let's start with on that dramatic note. Clearly, you do see things that in those dire terms?
Not quite that bad, Ian. That was sort of the blurb that Foreign Policy wrote about the piece that is in their current issue that I did author to get people like you to pay attention to it. I do raise...
You succeeded.
Yeah, exactly. It went a little too far. I do have some serious questions, though, about the conduct of monetary policy beginning in the late 1990s going up through the present day, where I do believe the Federal Reserve was far too accommodative in condoning one asset bubble after another, and now have a very difficult time in finding the exit strategy without really wreaking some havoc on financial markets and on those economies, namely the United States, that have become so incredibly dependent on the state of our asset markets.
In other words, we think we need, $1.5 billion a day to float our profligacy?
Well, that's the way we fund our current account deficit right now. We have to import foreign to an extraordinary degree right now to fund our lack of domestic savings. But look, it all started with the equity bubble. The equity bubble back in the late 1990s when the Federal Reserve, in the form of Alan Greenspan, in December of 1996, said, look, this is irrationally exuberant, and made an effort to tighten monetary policy in response to this speculative excess. He was skewered for that in early 1997, and then reversed course and came up with this concept of the new paradigm that led people to believe that, this is a good thing. And then, of course, the equity bubble did occur as he had originally expected, and then it popped, and he had to slash interest rates, and that has created more bubbles, bond bubbles, And now probably the biggest bubble of all, the housing bubble, which you know something about out there in Southern California.
Right, and that seems to be that if anything is going to burst and have a damaging ripple effect on the economy would be if the housing bubble bursts, because people on variables, given the fact that they're carrying so much personal debt, and energy prices and other things are going up, and interest rates are inevitably going to climb. How dire would your prediction be in terms of what would happen if the housing market started to unravel? And because all those people that got hooked on cheap money, many of them refinanced, but they didn't cut their monthly payments down. They consumed the surplus, did they not?
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, there are two ways that the housing, the demise of the housing bubble will hit the American consumer. One, the carrying cost on floating rate or variable rate, adjustable rate debt will go up, and that won't happen immediately because a lot of these mortgage instruments do not adjust instantaneously, but it will be a steady, unrelenting pressure over time. And then secondly, the housing bubble itself, if it does pop, Americans who are right now short of income growth and have drawn their income-based savings rates on average down to zero are going to find they don't have any house price appreciation to convert into purchasing power. So the consumption growth is going to go down. So the American consumer is an accident waiting to happen, and if the housing bubble pops, that is what could send more than a few through that proverbial windshield.
Well, let's talk about the Stephen Roach again, who's the chief economist at Morgan Stanley, and Stephen Roach has an article in the current issue of Foreign Policy, which is critical of our nation's economic and monetary policy. Obviously, the current accounts deficit is staggering, and the November figures were alarming, and the dollar is, of course, is plunging. Traditionally, in economics, it was always argued that if you devalue your dollar, it helps your exports. Is there any evidence that it is?
Not really. First of all, our manufacturing base is now really withered on the vine for a long, long time. So what little gain we get from a more competitive currency, in large part, just has a smaller impact on a much smaller slice of the economy, and the reason for that is just that the globalization has taken on a life of its own, and with countries like China and India and Mexico and Malaysia emerging as low-cost producers around the world, 5%, 10%, even a 20% decline in the dollar is not going to make that much of a difference.
But I understand as well that the United States has always been the principal recipient of investment money from around the world, and just recently China surpassed the United States, U.S. second and Mexico third, I believe.
Well,
or maybe India even surpassed Mexico, I'm not sure, but...
In terms of foreign direct investment?
Yes.
Well, in 2002 and 2003, China did become the largest recipient of foreign direct investment of any country in the world. The U.S. regained its once a perennial leadership position back in 2004 again, but China still remains an extraordinarily popular destination for foreign multinationals and foreign investors to buy direct pieces of Chinese production, plant, and equipment, and establish subsidiaries there.
And we apparently, basically, since the Chinese currency is pegged to the dollar, they buy our treasury notes more than anybody, don't they? The Chinese and I guess
the Japanese
too.
But the Chinese are right behind them.
Right. So they're buying. So just to run us through the deal here, because it seems, I mean, strange that this country should be so dependent upon a country to buy our to finance us, in effect, by buying our debt. What they get out of it is that they keep pumping their stuff into the malls, and we keep consuming. And it seems to me that there's got to be a limit to how much we can consume. And as they get more prosperous with 9% plus growth rates, they're going to their people are going to start demanding a higher standard of living, because in effect they're subsidizing our standard of living.
Well, Ian, you've got your finger on what is, I think, an increasingly insane strain of globalization, where Americans who are addicted to shopping, we've taken our savings rate, personal savings rate, down to zero. We can't buy enough. And the only reason we're able to fund our consumption is because our asset markets, like property, remain frothy. And they remain frothy because our interest rates are still at historic lows. And why do our interest rates stay down? In large part because the Chinese buy treasuries, which really puts a subsidy on our interest rate structure. And then we turn around playing that subsidized interest rates because our wealth effects go up, and we buy DVD players made in China. It's an utterly insane way to run the world. And it keeps going on until one day we wake up and we find ourselves with trade deficits that are utterly unsustainable, and the Chinese have an inflation problem because they've been printing too much money to buy our treasuries, and the world stops as we know it, and it'll be a very, very painful adjustment. We're deluding ourselves into thinking this is the correct way to run the world.
And Stephen Roach, what is it then if the our manufacturing base is hollowed out, if the falling dollar is not stimulating and helping exports? The question, I guess, is what do we export, and what in the future will generate wealth in this country?
Well, the models of the so-called post-industrial, post-manufacturing society are largely services-based, resting primarily on intellectual capital, knowledge workers, white-collar workers, peddling their wares as idea generators, and the service economy is probably two-thirds of our overall economy right now, and so we tend to think this is fine. You know, it's good for us to buy cheap manufactured products made in Asia, as long as we are shielded from competition as knowledge workers. That model's breaking down now, because the Indias of the world, who are aggressively providing knowledge-based skills from software programming, engineering, design, lawyers, and the like, they're now competing in this what we call non-tradable services sector. So the problem with the United States is we're in denial over these competitive pressures, and we are consuming as if we're generating income the old-fashioned way, and really we're not.
But if our future that we stay in the game as the sort of economic hegemon, not to mention the military hegemon, if we're to stay in the game, you're saying that our strength is in knowledge-based assets. These things seem to be, given how much counterfeiting goes on in China, and recently the Indians, for example, synthesized an AIDS drug where they took elements of a whole bunch of cocktails that our pharmaceutical companies have developed and put them into one. You know what's going on in Africa with AIDS. So it seems to me that the value of our knowledge-based economy has tremendous moral implications to the developing world, and I can't see them sitting back and just paying Microsoft and our pharmaceutical companies what the market will bear.
Well, I think that's a profound question for the fabric of globalization, both in economic terms, social terms, and ultimately moral and geopolitical terms. I don't pretend to really have the right answer here. I think that the protection of intellectual capital, intellectual property, is paramount as countries like the United States or regions like Europe or Japan compete primarily and generate income largely in these knowledge-based endeavors. The good news is that China, for example, has recently joined the World Trade Organization, and a number of charges have been leveled at China, and some have been adjudicated in America's favor, some have been adjudicated in China's favor on precisely this issue. And as long as we encourage the developing world to join our rules-based trading system, we do have recourse to deal with these issues. But we can't delude ourselves in thinking that the litigious answer is the right answer. We have to maintain the edge technologically to compete with very skilled workforces in places like China and India. And we also, though, have to learn to get our own house in order and get our national savings rate up. And we're not doing that right now. So this is a shared responsibility. We can't just pin the blame on someone else.
Well, finally, Stephen Roach, what's your feeling about the economic stewardship? You have misgivings about Alan Greenspan, but what about President Bush and John Snow? And, I mean, it seems to me that their basic economic plan is to partially privatize Social Security, and I don't know that that's a particularly profound. Well, certainly not addressing any of the issues that we've been talking about.
No, they're not. To me, the biggest problem that America suffers today is a profound shortfall of national savings. And by national savings, I mean the combined savings of individuals, businessmen, and the government sector. Our national savings rate, adjusted for depreciation over the last 3 years, has averaged only 1.5% of our gross domestic product. Those are historic lows. We've got to raise our national savings rate. The privatization of Social Security doesn't do one thing to the national savings rate. It just rearranges the deck chairs on the Titanic. It shifts savings from one sector to another. And what does worry me about the economic stewardship of our fiscal and monetary authorities right now is they're not focused on what needs to be done for an aging U.S. economy, that's raising our national savings rate.
And in terms of the, if there's going to be, I take it from what you're telling us that the scariest scenario is the housing bubble bursting. And is there any indication that I'm hearing that the individual indebtedness is going up quite rapidly, and a lot of it's to do with out of control rising healthcare costs. So, do you see any restraint on the possibility that the bubble will burst and the people just simply, they're broke. They're in so.
Look, the debt numbers you cite are alarming. The debt ratios, household debt ratios to GDP, have been going up at an astronomical rate over the last 4 to 5 years. The real problem, though, is that we've now moved into bubble territory for nationwide house prices, not just in California. We have 25 states plus the District of Columbia now running double-digit house price inflation through the third quarter of 2004, the last number we have. The increase for the nation as a whole is plus 13%. These are 25-year highs. So the asset in question has moved into bubble territory, and it does reflect interest rates and savings rates that are at unsustainable lows that need to go up. So we're on a collision course, and if we don't wake up to it, as I said earlier, somebody's going to go through the windshield, and it's probably going to be the American consumer.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Stephen Roach.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. You're speaking then with Stephen Roach, who's the chief economist at Morgan Stanley. He has an article in the current issue of foreign policy, which is critical of our nation's economic and monetary policy. And I'm now speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Councils under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. He's been a biographer of President Nixon, and you've also completing a book on the history of foreign policy and covert foreign policy in Southwest Asia, which is very much, and the Middle East, which Iraq and Afghanistan being among them. And it seems earlier I just posed a question to Mark Danner, our first guest, whether he's off to Iraq on Wednesday and whether or not this forthcoming election will be used as a sort of fig leaf to get out. It's interesting to note that about a week ago, Brent Scowcroft at a conference in Washington, D.C., the former National Security Advisor under President Bush Sr. said that he thought that rather than bring democracy and stability, the election in Iraq was likely to precipitate a civil war. So I guess, Roger, the question is, do you think that this administration is sufficiently cynical to just declare victory and get out?
Well, I think they're sufficiently cynical. I agree with Mark Danner that it's very difficult, it's very problematic to bring that kind of military occupation to any kind of immediate end. I think it's going to be a slower and bloodier process than many might hope. But I do think there is a struggle for the soul, such as it is, of this administration going on right now. There are clearly those in its corporate base and even in its congressional base who are not happy with the way things have been going in Iraq, who would like to fashion some kind of exit. Of course, there's a total lack, Ian, as you know, of any real concept of how to do that. I think they're in a quandary about what kind of fig leaf exactly they could construct. They've invested so much in this, Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld in particular, but I do think the impetus will be very, very strong to use this election as some kind of pretext to begin to scale back the American involvement. But it's going to be, as you pointed out in your conversation with Mark Danner, an extremely damaging and potentially bloodier consequence for the United States in terms of the impact and on opinion in the Middle East and the kind of vindication that it does give al-Qaeda, after all.
But isn't it? It's also true that every day that the U.S. is there, it just gets worse. So, at a certain point, they're going to have to cut their losses, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. I think that's the calamity, the real war crime of this administration, that they've put us in an absolute dead end. You know, if you compare the options of withdrawing from Vietnam, they were much, much less dire in terms of the impact of on American interests. There was a kind of consensus, after all, even among the great powers, among the Chinese and the Soviets, as well as the United States, that we had to fashion that exit, and we did so, and the North Vietnamese triumphed in the South without any, as we know, any great consequence in American foreign policy or interest in Southeast Asia or anywhere else. The domino theory did not happen, as had been so often predicted. This is a very, very different and much more serious, much more disastrous sequence of events, and it seems to me that there is no easy way out of this. A catastrophe if we stay, a catastrophe if we go, and we simply the difference there is the venue.
Well, Roger Morris, the thing that's been very frustrating for me is to feel as though and watch the absolute lack of a political opposition in this country to articulate how bad the situation is. I think the press has got blood on their hands because so many of them were cheerleaders in getting us into this war. And I imagine if we just pull out, they'll just forget about it like it never happened. So who will tell the people? I mean, only when the people of this country realize what a mess this president's got this country in and the boys and girls that he's put in harm's way recklessly. I mean, it's a flagrant example of the impetuous and immature use of American power undermining America's strength.
You know, I think, Ian, when the history of this era comes to be written, that in the end, the Democrats in the Congress, and certainly John Kerry's presidential campaign, and obviously the media, will bear an awful and awesome responsibility for what's happened here. There has been no loyal opposition of any kind. The Democrats chose, in their usual craven manner, to be Bush light, to be the neocons light in their campaign, with their fingers in the wind. It led to an electoral disaster. But in the longer run, the absolute absence of any articulated alternative vision, the absence of any real watchdog role in the Congress or in the press, has made all of this worse. Of course, there is a viable exit strategy. It's not being articulated by the opposition. It would involve the kind of searching reappraisal of American policy in the Middle East, which neither party has had the courage or the wisdom to undertake, which means reexamining our relationship with Israel, to the whole Israeli-Palestinian question, to our relationship with all of the autocratic and really undemocratic regimes that we're tied up with in the Middle East, a reexamination of the last 50 years of history. But since we have no opposition to begin that great debate or to even bring it forward, there is no alternative vision. And I think that's what makes, incidentally, so fateful the kind of post-election struggle for power and the intellectual soul of the Democratic Party so crucial. There is a kind of battle going on to see if the conventional wisdom and the conventional Washington hangers-on will triumph, or if some of the new people brought into the process by Howard Dean and others in the campaign can find a voice. And, you know, we saw just this week George Soros and a number of big contributors to the Democratic opposition promising to fund with as much as $50 million some kind of renaissance of Democratic policy thinking. If that money, of course, goes into the conventional wisdom and into the usual channels in Washington, the Beltway miasma, it will be totally wasted.
Well, you know, I often mentioned that, you know, that the Marxists haven't had an original idea for, 80-plus years. It looks as though the Democrats haven't had an original idea since what?
I was thinking about this the other day. The Democrats really haven't had a fresh idea in foreign policy since the Peace Corps, and God knows that was even cribbed from the old CCC of the New Deal. They really haven't had a major success in foreign policy since the Marshall Plan. It's one of the most barren half-century records in foreign policy. They've been cowed ever since Joe McCarthy on the national security issue. There was a fateful battle within the party right after World War II, won by the conservatives, and it's silenced for the better part of the 20th century and now into the 21st, any real opposition, and we're not talking the silly old dichotomy between left and right. The new thinking in foreign policy is not left. It's not in any sense in those old categories. It's about a new world of globalism and new challenges, both material and in a sense spiritual, and that thinking simply doesn't fall into those old categories. So, meanwhile, the Democratic Party is mired in the same place it was nearly 60, 70 years ago.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Councils under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, and is a biographer of Richard Nixon. And your book on the history of our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan and Southwest Asia, when's it coming out?
I hope will be coming out this next spring or summer, and that sort of depends, as you know, on the caprice of publishers. But it's very much in the final stages, and that history, of course, shows so vividly that all of this did not begin with George Bush. I was just thinking, listening to your earlier conversation, all of these economic disasters that we are on the verge of here, of course, did not begin with Bush either. This is the cumulative total of a lot of neglect and of the bipartisan misrule in Washington. And what my history shows is that there are lots and lots of fathers of this disaster, going back to Presidents Carter and Reagan, and to Henry Kissinger and to a lot of other figures long before George W. Bush. But this administration has really been, as you've pointed out so often, over the top. Their excesses, their heedlessness, their hubris is really quite unprecedented in American foreign policy. We've blundered before, but we've never blundered so grandly.
Well, ironically, it takes people like Brent Scowcroft, who's a Republican, to create an opposition debate.
You know, that's the most embarrassing thing of all. The absolute silence from the ranking people in the Democratic Party, those policy advisors around John Kerry, my old friend Dick Holbrook, and others like Tony Lake and Sandy Berger, people who served in the Clinton administration, people who served earlier in the Carter years.
Well, Tony Lake served with you on the National Security Council under Kissinger, did he?
Absolutely. No, I've known these guys for 40 years, and there's no other way to say it. It's quite a craven and I think disastrous silence on their part. But you know, the problem here is that they don't really disagree that much with these neocons. They would like to do it in a more polite and more diplomatic, more tactful way, but there is not that much difference. The real opposition in American foreign policy is at the grassroots and in some quarters of academia, and it's largely unheard and unseen. It needs to be out there in the political mainstream, but of course it needs also political champions. We need a genuine opposition voice in Washington, and it's not there either in the media or in the government.
And if you're doing a book on Iraq and the Middle East and Southwest Asia, I mean, you're how are you going to handle what's going to happen in Iraq? I mean, if I'm correct in thinking that the contours of a civil war are already pretty apparent, and that this regime that we have in Washington are both incompetent and deeply cynical, and that they'll just, you know, get out and cut their losses at some point. What kind of an end game would we have? I mean, the idea of Iraq, the second largest oil supply in the world, being Al Qaeda's playground is
well, it's going
pretty
to be
dire.
It was always, and I think this is one of the things my book points out. Beginning in the 1950s, we saw the Iraqis, of course, as a very formidable power in the Middle East, right along with Egypt, with Colonel Nasser, and that was the justification for our meddling so long and so often. We've been involved covertly there since the 1950s. I think it's inevitable, Ian, that Iraq will be a very hostile regime. It will only be a matter of time until it again embarks on a nuclear weapons program. It will have a formidable military force sooner or later. You know, it'll be a much more hostile and dangerous place under a quasi-democratic regime or a coalition Sunni-Shia regime, even with the Kurds involved, than it was under Saddam Hussein. I mean, I just think this is one of the tolls of the complete lack of understanding. At root, all of these problems trace to this colossal American ignorance of the countries that we're dealing with and manipulating, and where we almost inevitably make matters worse.
Well, my feeling is that these people, Bush, is such an incompetent that, in fact, the United States has been played. The Bush administration has been played. The neocons got conned. I think Netanyahu and the right-wing Israelis are happy to see Iraq as a failed state and the neighborhood destabilized, and they'd love it if the Shia and the Sunni went to war. The Saudis are happy to have all of Iraq's oil off the market. It's, after all, the second-largest supplier. So that puts the Saudis in charge of the oil market and prevents a glut on the market. And we know that the Iranians played us through Chalabi, who's always been an Iranian asset, and the Iranians are just patiently waiting to pick up their friendly surrogate government if the Shia win the civil war, which I guess...
You know, this is I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a correct analysis, and it's the oldest, saddest story in American foreign policy. We've been played by our so-called allies and friends for a very long time now. We've been the ultimate Westerner hustled in the East, and that's been going... It went on, of course, in Afghanistan, where we were enthralled to Pakistani national policy and interests, and in hawk to the ISI there, and we've been played by the Iranians, both under the Shah and then under this this successor regime. You're absolutely right, and that's because, of course, not only are we ignorant of this area, we have no coherent sense of what our ultimate long-term national interest ought to be in this part of the world. No one is looking at where America should be or wants to be in the year 2025 or 2050. And these all are cultures that look ahead in foreign affairs and in politics much more effectively than we do. We're paying an awful price for our naivete.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer, Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Carol Cooth, the assistant producer. This program and all others are available at ianmasters.org. ianmasters.org. Bye for now.